Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. Good morning. The court has a total of six matters on its oral submission docket. The first set of three and the second set of two have been consolidated for oral argument. And in the order of their appearance, they are docket numbers 050734, 0762, and 0763, Mission Consolidated Independent School District versus Gloria Garcia, Melinda Satoyu, and Deborah Medina from Hidalgo County and the 13th Court of Appeals District. Docket numbers 060050 and 0172, the State of Texas versus Barbara Oakley as guardian of the estate and person of Richard Danziger from Travis County and the 3rd Court of Appeals District. And docket number 060414, In Re Team Rocket LP, MLF Airframes, Inc., and Mark L. Frederick, an original proceeding. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side for each of these arguments, and the court will take a brief recess between the arguments. We expect to conclude all of them before noon. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is ready to hear argument in 050734, 0762, and 0763, the Mission Consolidated Independent School District cases.
May it please the court, Mr. Hansen will present argument for the petitioner. The petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Court. Counsel. Good morning. My name is David Hansen, and I'm here on behalf of the Mission Consolidated Independent School District. Today, the court will, for the first time, have the opportunity to consider the newly reenacted Section 101.106 of the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code. This statute has, for the past 25 years or so, been very important in the area of employee immunity. Today, if the court chooses to apply the statute as written to this case, it will also become a very important case in the area of governmental immunity. We ask the court for relief from the decision of the Court of Appeals because the Court of Appeals committed several errors. The first, they all root from rules of statutory construction, and that error in the statutory construction led to their erroneous application of the statute to the case at hand. MCISD filed its plea to the jurisdiction based on Section 101.106B of the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code. It reads, "The filing of a suit against any employee of a governmental unit constitutes an irrevocable election by the plaintiff and immediately and forever bars any suit or recovery by the plaintiff against the governmental unit regarding the same subject matter unless the governmental unit consents." Now, there are several things that are not an issue here. There has been no issue made of whether or not the governmental unit consented. It did not. There is also no issue about whether or not this involves an employee of the governmental unit. That was on the face of the pleadings, that it was a former superintendent of the school district, Mr. Dyer. And then the third, there is no issue about whether or not we're a governmental unit. The only issue that seems to have arisen, or the only two issues, are whether it arises from the same subject matter and whether or not this is any suit. As to the issue of whether or not it arises from the same subject matter, remembering that this is a plea to the jurisdiction, we accept all of the facts that are pled in the petition as true. And as you go through the petition, and as I've cited in my brief, we see that nearly all the claims are pled against both defendants in the plural. But the claims are not what determines what the subject matter is. As this court has recognized on numerous occasions, subject matter is determined based upon the facts and whether or not these claims arise from the same set of transactions or occurrences. And in this case, all of the claims arise out of the termination of the three respondents in this case. They are discrimination claims that they were that the termination amounted to an intentional infliction of emotional distress, that the reasons for the termination were defamatory in nature. So they all certainly arise out of the same occurrence, which was the termination.
Let me ask you this.
Yes, Your Honor.
If we read 101.106 subsection B the way you want us to read it, it would completely vitiate subsection E, wouldn't it, in every instance?
No, Your Honor, it wouldn't, because based on the statutory construction, let me go ahead and explain that. Let's take, for example, a case where there is a suit that's under this chapter. A good example would be if we have a bus accident at a school district, and the employee and the employer are both sued. In that case, you apply E, and that escorts out the employee, because that E is a procedural mechanism, not a statute, not a jurisdictional section of the statute. And then A keeps them from coming back in. Do we apply B? The answer to that question will be no. B won't apply. And we can take a look at, or one of the reasons that we look at that is if, and as Justice Xavier Rodriguez has decided in the Western District Court, that if the school district files a motion under E, then it is consented suit. By asking that it be held accountable for the claims.
Well, let me follow up on Justice O'Neill's question. Because I had really the same one, whether E would be redundant under your theory. The legislature has given us both A and B, and the way it works is any suit against the government or its employee immediately bars suit against the other. So if they're both sued at once regarding the same subject matter, then both suits are immediately and forever barred. Isn't that right?
They are immediately and forever barred, but remember, E, it's not a redundancy. There is no motion to dismiss in Texas. In the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure. So what this does is it creates a procedural mechanism where you simply, rather than filing a plea to the jurisdiction, the school district simply files this motion pursuant to...
But under subsection E, if both the employer and employee are sued, under A or B, I can't remember which one, the employer has already been immediately dismissed, so how would they move to dismiss the lawsuit?
No, Your Honor. As you'll see, it's under this chapter. In order to determine which provision of this claim... which provision applies, you have to look at two things, whether or not the claims arise from the same subject matter and the claims that were filed. Now, the Court of Appeals held that this can only be used to eliminate claims that are under this chapter. And actually, that's where you'll run into trouble. So let's take this example of the bus accident, and we'll look at both E and F to see how this works. You, as I said earlier, if you have E and F, or rather, if you have a suit and both the employee and the employer have been sued, then you will go ahead and use that procedural mechanism and escort out the employee. Now, will you apply B? Now, one of the errors that the Court of Appeals made was that they engrafted onto the statute, onto B, the language under this chapter. Now,
well,
if you do,
of course, yes, they did, because an employee sued is not a sovereign, and so it would not make sense to say employee under this chapter.
And it makes just as little sense to say any suit against a governmental unit under this chapter, because you see in B that's where they talk about any suit, because it says and forever bars any suit or recovery by the plaintiff against a governmental unit. And there, nowhere in there is under this chapter. Now, the legislature clearly showed that if it wanted to limit the application of one of the statutes to a claim that was under this chapter, it could have done so because it did so in three other areas in this statute. So, what can that mean? Well, let's see if it applies in F. Now, F occurs in this bus accident case, and where they just sued the bus driver. Now, the bus driver is sued, and so we'll look, and we'll apply F, and we'll say, if a suit is filed against the employee of a governmental unit based on conduct within the general scope of the employee's employment, and here you have all of those things satisfied, he's driving his bus, he runs into a car, and if it could have been brought under this chapter against the governmental unit, and it's a bus accident, it could have been brought under this chapter against a governmental unit, then the suit is considered to be against the employee in the employee's official capacity only. Now, if it's in his official capacity only, that's the same thing as a suit against a governmental unit. Now, let's see if B will apply in that circumstance. It says the filing of a suit against any employee. Is the suit against the employee? As a matter of law, pursuant to F, it is not. It's deemed against the employee in the employee's official capacity only, and the government unit is substituted for the government unit is substituted for the employee. So in that case, B wouldn't apply. So when will, if B only applies when to claims under this chapter, when will it ever apply? Because under B requires three things. It requires that more than one person be sued, an employee of a governmental unit and the employer, and it requires that they arise from the same subject matter. In other words, it will never apply. And as Justice Brisser has stated in Dale Hyde versus Nauta, a statute should not be interpreted to be pointless. And that is precisely what happens if you engraft on the statute this requirement that it be under this chapter. Now, when will it apply? Again, we look at the claims, and if there are not claims under this chapter, and it's a suit against both the governmental unit and its employee arising from the same subject matter, we all know the only time a court has a jurisdiction over a suit is where the legislature waives sovereign immunity from suit. So it's going to have to, if it's going to have any point to it at all, it's going to have a point that eliminates claims where there has been a waiver of sovereign immunity against a governmental unit. I've already showed how if you do apply it, if you try and engraft under this chapter on there, it will either become a nullity or in some circumstances a meat grinder.
Well, this is a confusing area of the law. It strikes me, and what I'm grappling with in this case is, you've got a number of common law claims that the state's immune from anyway.
That's right.
So regardless, you could get out on those claims. So what we're really talking about is the claims under the Human Rights Act.
Yes, Your Honor.
For discrimination.
Yes, Your Honor.
And it would be fairly esoteric to say that the Human Rights Act, which specifically waives immunity against the school district, is wiped out through this subsection B of 101.106. I mean, that's hard for me to figure out how the legislature would have wanted to do that.
Well, actually, that's what they said. They used any suit, which is actually similar to the language from the previous version of the statute, which said any action, but as this court has held in Thomas versus Oldham, action is synonymous with suit. So as you held in Bell versus Love, any suit means any suit. And now, given at that time when you rendered that decision, we were talking about suits against employees. But as Justice Green held in Urban versus Canada, there is where there was a statutory libel claim that was dismissed. The fact that it's embodied in some other statute, it doesn't really matter. Any suit means any suit. And
so
if we're going to,
the legislature then intended to allow a waiver of immunity against school districts for discrimination under the Human Rights Act and to discourage suits against employees?
No. Actually, the legislature intended to, as the dissent in the Waxahachie versus Johnson said, take a meat cleaver to the cases and say, look, if you have something that's arising out of the same subject matter, we're not going to let you sue both the employee and the governmental unit. In the interest of judicial economy, you pick one or you pick the other. And if you look at A and B and the way that they work together, understanding that B is never going to be applicable when the claim is under this chapter, you'll see that there are the yin and the yang. That they take every suit against a governmental unit and its employee, and so long as it arises from the same subject matter, it halves it and says, you're free to pursue your claims. Now, the question might be, well, what happens? What then would happen in the case of somebody who's been discriminated against? Well, this statute isn't going to apply to get rid of federal claims because of the supremacy clause. So if someone feels like they still need to pursue their claims for discrimination, they're free to go ahead and file something under Title VII or perhaps under the United States Constitution alleging discrimination. This is strictly dealing with what's in the purview of the legislature. And what was certainly in their minds, and as this court has held on many occasions, the court or the legislature is deemed to be cognizant of all the laws and the decisions that have been rendered surrounding those laws when it enacts a statute. And if that rule of construction applies here, then it certainly, when they say any case, they certainly don't mean in no case. They mean any case. And they were certainly cognizant of that, and they could have carved out an exception there had they wished to.
If the plaintiff had simply sued the district and the employee for discrimination under the Human Rights Act, and not alleged any other claims, would the result be different?
If they had sued the school district and the employee under the Human Rights Act
alone.
They wouldn't be able to sue an employee under the Human Rights Act because the Human Rights Act only applies to governmental units. But the result, I think, as harsh as it sounds, the result would be the same. You would cleave it. And because this says any suit, that claim against the employer of discrimination would be dismissed. Now, the way that this statute should have applied in this case would be to have looked at it and said, we are a governmental unit. They sued a governmental employee. Any suit means any suit, just like it always has. And certainly, looking at the history of this statute and the history of that particular piece of language that broad statement, which was imported from the previous statute, it can come to no other conclusion than that this case should have been dismissed and that there is no jurisdiction over this case pursuant to 101-106B. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Counselor. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondents.
May it please the court, Ms. Robinson will present argument for the respondents.
May it please the court and the opposing counsel. There are two reasons that the requested relief from the school district should not be granted. The first reason is that long-standing rules of construction do not support their interpretation of this statute. The second reason is that basic public policy enunciated in 1969, which has not changed to the present, does not favor the interpretation that they have reached because they reach a conclusion that is contrary to the goal of the statute. If you look at the public policy embodied in the whole of the statute, the whole of the statute has six parts. It is not six separate statutes. As a matter of statutory construction, it is long-standing law that you look at the purpose, the intent of the whole statute. The whole statute is intended to do two things. It's intended to prevent a double recovery, which is unfair to the public treasury, and it is intended to protect the employees. Protecting the employees is not an altruistic act. It is in the benefit of the governmental entity to do so. As the insurance companies have long known, when you control the defense of a lawsuit, you control the costs, you can cap the damages by settling early or settling fairly. You can prevent a conflict between yourself, the governmental entity, and the employees, and protect from any possible collusion. Collusion is not a wild assertion because particularly the TCHRA, the Texas Commission on Human Rights Act, covers sexual harassment. Sexual harassment cases frequently have a romantic portion. It is not unheard of for victims and the aggressor in a sexual harassment case to cooperate in those lawsuits. They may get married later on down the road. So the public purpose embodied in the Election of Remedies statute is to protect the government by allowing them to control the litigation. They control the costs. They get to use their caps. They get to prevent any conflict with the employees, and they get to wipe away the specter of collusion. The Texas Commission on Human Rights Act is a separate waiver of sovereign immunity from the Tort Claims Act. The Tort Claims Act acknowledges that there are other waivers of sovereign immunity in 101-103, where it says the Tort Claims Act is in addition to other remedies. Under the Texas Commission on Human Rights Act, only the employer can be sued. You don't sue an employee. Under the Texas Tort Claims Act, intentional torts cannot be raised. Non-use of tangible property cannot be raised. There are a lot of things that the governmental entity has not waived immunity for, and that an individual who's perhaps acting with malice could be responsible for.
Do you think it's true that you can only sue a governmental unit under the Tort Claims Act?
No, sir, I don't. The Texas Commission on Human Rights Act is an independent waiver of immunity. It mentions it in the definition of an employer. It's very clear that state instrumentalities are a portion of the employer definition. It says you can sue an employer. They define it to include the government. There is a separate damages provision that says that the state will pay attorney's fees just like any private person.
I understand that point, but what about the Tort Claims Act?
The Tort Claims Act is in addition to other remedies.
I understand that, but can you sue an employee under, whatever that means, the Tort Claims Act?
No, sir. If you have...
You can't sue an employee under the Tort Claims Act or under the Human Rights Act.
You cannot sue an employee under those causes of action. You can sue an employee for the same subject matter.
Right. But you can't... it wouldn't make any sense in B to say the filing of a suit against any employee of governmental unit under this chapter, because you can't sue an employee under the chapter.
Absolutely correct. And I think that goes against the interpretation proffered by the district. It's clear why that language is not in there.
It seems to support the district view. The filing of any suit against the employee of government for anything, because it wouldn't make any sense to put it under this chapter, constitutes an irrevocable election not to sue the unit regarding the same subject matter.
Right. Right.
That seems to be the district's argument.
Yes. And I think the interpretation given to it by the Court of Appeals is regarding the same subject matter, that regarding the same subject matter would have to arise under the Texas Tort Claims Act for the Texas Tort Claims Act election of remedies to apply. Mm-hmm. It is not that the filing of suit against any employee under this chapter. It is the same subject matter under this chapter.
Of course, it doesn't say that.
No, sir, it does not. It is a logical extension because of the way that the entire statute is structured. And the problems about the difference between the types of things that you can sue a governmental entity for and that you can sue an individual for.
What are good reasons for suing the employee if you have cause of action regarding the same subject matter against the government itself?
If there is a close question concerning official capacity, whether there was a action by an individual that was within his course and scope and within his authorization, or whether it was a ultra vires sort of action, where there is a factual question about whether the employee was acting on behalf of the government or whether he was acting on his own behalf.
And if the latter, does the state have to indemnify the judgment, or you just go against the employee for whatever he's got?
I think you go against the employee for whatever he's got, but the state would prefer to defend that cause of action. You know, there's a difference between defense costs and indemnity costs. The judgment may have to be borne by the individual, but the cost of defense, it's clearly in the government's best interest to defend the lawsuit.
And you think that a concern is that the government will say, well, Sure, he did it, but he wasn't acting for us. And so
that's
you can't
a concern.
Get him, you can't get us, and you haven't sued him.
That's a concern, and the defense counsel who are handling that will have to work out that potential conflict between the government position and the individual's position. The individual likewise has a clear interest in saying, no, I was in course and scope, I was authorized to do this. You know, we have these secret memos in my desk that prove that I had told my supervisors I wanted to do this. And so the defense counsel remains in control of that conflict and the way that conflict is presented to the finder of fact. The public treasury can be depleted directly by judgments against it, by costs of defending suit. It can also be depleted indirectly by employees having to purchase insurance for potential liability. The legislature is very clear in this statute that they want the government to take on the defense and to maintain control of that litigation.
Under the district's reading of this statute, would there be any way for a plaintiff to sue both and continue to maintain that lawsuit against the individual and the government? Individual for those actions that would not otherwise be barred, and against the district for the human rights violations?
I don't think so. I think the statute does now, under E and F, force an election, and you have to take your chances. You know, if there is a close question of the official capacity of an individual, there would be a factual finding by the trial court under F about whether or not he was acting in his official capacity. And my assumption is that the same process that that this court announced in the Miranda case versus Texas Parks and Wildlife would apply, that as a plea to the jurisdiction, you would have a fact finding. The trial court would make a finding of fact about whether or not he was in the official capacity. But there's another issue that's not directly addressed by this lawsuit, but that is coming your way, about whether or not this entire statute is an immunity statute. There is one decision out there that if the employee is dismissed from the lawsuit, that is could not be the subject of an interlocutory appeal. I think it makes better sense for both the governmental entity to be able to pursue an interlocutory appeal and the employee to be able to pursue an interlocutory appeal, because it so mangles the case, it so directs the case for that kind of a fact-finding to be made early on in the lawsuit, that if there is a controversy over it, it needs to be resolved, or you waste a lot of money defending the lawsuit twice.
What case are you referring to?
Westlaw 29-10-14. The issue of subject matter, whether this arises out of the same subject matter, has not been determined. The trial court didn't reach it, the Court of Appeals didn't reach it, and quite frankly, the pleadings are deficient. So we go back to Miranda versus Texas Parks and Wildlife. And at some point, the trial court is going to need to have a hearing. Probably there will be special exceptions and amendments to clarify that issue. At this point, without special exceptions, without a finding about whether or not there is subject matter or whether it is the same subject matter, and I would contend that a defamation claim is a whole lot different than a Texas Commission on Human Rights discrimination claim. There really isn't any finding one way or the other whether or not this is in the same subject matter. The Waxahachie case, of course, found that a plaintiff who had been arrested, he said maliciously, and then 2 months later was terminated, the Waxahachie Court of Appeals found that that was not the same subject matter. We don't have a timeline in these pleadings. We don't have a good set of facts set out in these pleadings. So at this point, we're not able to say that it is or is not the same subject matter. This is a straight-up case of statutory construction. and the longstanding principles that we would rely on as statutory construction is that you look first to the intent of the statute as a whole, and then you interpret the statute based on that. You don't read any part of it to make it a nullity. I think Justice O'Neill is absolutely correct that if you read the statute the way the district is asking, you obviate Section E, which clearly was not their intent. And I think in this case we don't have any issue about whether or not the government's policy is a rational policy, because it's very clear that it benefits the government to control the litigation.
So you don't like the argument that Section E is a procedural mechanism that allows the vehicle called a motion to dismiss to be filed, which does not exist, at least by name, in our Rules of Civil Procedure.
I know that it doesn't exist in our Rules of Civil Procedure, but I sure see a lot of them. And they're misnamed. They're pleas to the jurisdiction. They're this, they're that. I think the better reading is that this entire thing, because it's part of the Tort Claims Act, is a modification of sovereign immunity. As an immunity question, a plea to the jurisdiction is the better procedural device. And so whether it adds a new level of civil procedure without this court's enactment of a Texas rule of civil procedure, I don't think it does. I think we have adequate procedures already.
Any further questions?
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Hanson, I want to make sure I heard you right when you were responding to Judge O'Neill earlier. Just to make sure I'm clear, did you suggest that under your sort of any suit means any suit theory,
Your Honor,
that if a victim of race discrimination brought a standalone claim for that under the Human Rights Act, that claim would be barred?
If they tried to bring a claim against the employee arising from the same subject matter, yes, it would be barred. Yes, it would. The statute's very clear. May I address a couple of points that were raised here? The question of subject matter is not determined by what claims are filed. So as was just suggested here, that somehow the subject matter is different simply because it is stated in terms of a Tort Claims Act claim versus a discrimination claim. That's not how you decide what subject matter is. Subject matter is decided by the facts. And this court held that in MHMR versus Bosley in another case interpreting Section 101.106. So that's very clear law. Can this be harsh? Yes, it can. But what will be harsher? Here we have this statute, and if we have a suit against an employee and the government entity for a bus accident, and we adopt the interpretation somehow of the Court of Appeals, which says that you use B to dismiss or to bar claims under this chapter, then you've got not a meat cleaver, which seems somewhat grotesque, but not so much when you look at it in what it would become is a meat grinder. Because if you can only apply this in claims that are under this chapter, then you are completely eliminating the cause of action that a person may have for a legitimate claim where they were run over by a bus. Because you either use E or F to get the employee out and substitute the government entity, and then you apply B, because that's the only time the Court of Appeals says that this will apply, is to dismiss claims under this chapter. But that's not right. That's not how they wrote it. This statute is pretty straightforward if you look at it for a couple of years like I have, but it's pretty straightforward. If you think about these in terms of what E and F are, and they're just procedural mechanisms, and you will be seeing this section in Viasan versus O'Rourke, where they're claiming that E is not the jurisdictional bar. It's A. E escorts them out, and A is the procedural bar. That's where you'd file the plea to the jurisdiction if they ever tried to bring them back in.
Is there any claim here that invokes the use of tangible personal property provision of the Tort Claims Act?
No, Your Honor, there isn't. There is no claim in here that arises under this chapter. And if there were a claim that arose under this chapter, then we would be applying E, and Mr. Dyer would be out, and then A to keep him out. So if there were any claim under here that arose under this chapter, that's what we would be doing. The statute, or it was said just a moment ago that the statute was intended to protect employees. And there's language all over the case law in 101.106 saying that. But that's before they added the Section B and Section D, whose only purpose is to eliminate claims against, or is to bar claims against the government. So it's somewhat erroneous to go back to that language now in light of this newly reenacted statute and say that there is no policy in here to protect government units. The policy is to create efficiency, and that is to eliminate at the get-go and to force the plaintiffs to decide, am I going to file a shotgun pleading and let the statute decide who I sue, or am I going to do a reasonable amount of research into this? I've got most of the time, I've got quite a long time to determine what's going on here. In fact, if it's a TCHR claim, they have the whole TCHR process to go through to determine who they're going to sue. And the statute simply asks them to be accountable for that.
So if they had not included the individuals here, they would still be in court. But because they named the individual, everything else is thrown out.
Yes, Your Honor. And that's because B will never apply. None of these provisions will ever apply when only one is sued. And that's the best indication of all of what the intention of the legislature was when it enacted this.
I think the government and the employee both should be able to have an interlocutory appeal.
Well, an interlocutory appeal may lie under A, but for the employee, because as this court held in Harris County versus Sykes, this is an immunity statute. So they would file a summary judgment asserting immunity in A. And so it's possible that they might have an interlocutory appeal, both of them, under the right.
Any further questions? Thank you, Counselor. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
Thank you very much.